This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Torture testing banks.
Don't forget, not everyone got a passing grade from the Fed.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, March 14th.
Coming up, is that a cloud over the solar power business?
And what happens when I try to pay less for gasoline?
Plus the smell of the Yankees.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
The American banking system seems a safer place after America's central bank, the Fed, released the results of its torture tests yesterday. Marketplace's Gregory Warner begins our coverage.
The Fed wanted to test whether banks could still keep lending money if we had another huge recession. Anthony Sanders is professor of finance at George Mason University's Mercatus Center. He lays out the scenario, and I feel the need to say this is just a test.
13% unemployment, 50% drop in stock market, and 21% further decline in house prices.
Okay, I'm stressed. But 15 of the 19 biggest banks passed the test. They had enough cash on hand to weather the storm. That's a far cry from 2009, when the Fed ran a similar hypothetical and banks fell short by $75 billion.
So the banks are in much healthier shape than they were the last time they ran the stress test.
Banks celebrated with plans to raise dividends and buy back stocks. Those plans sent their stocks climbing. Sanders says that the banks that did the worst in the test all had one thing in common. They all own the mortgages on a lot of troubled homes in the South. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
When the Federal Reserve tried out those bad case scenarios in the banking system, it turned up some red alerts about Europe in particular. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us from London. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Stephen, I see Citigroup and some other banks own quite a lot of European debt, debt that could go bad.
Yes, I mean, Citigroup has been badly hit, undoubtedly, by its exposure to the Eurozone debt crisis. Citi points out, however, that even with these losses, it would have passed the stress test. It only failed because the Fed objected to Citi's plans to increase its payout to shareholders. But one leading bank analyst here thinks Citigroup's failure is pretty alarming.
Alarming? You have my full attention here.
Right. Well, this is Ralph Silver of the research house SRN, and he says he finds it extraordinary that stock markets are celebrating on the back of these stress test results, given the fact that Citi has not been given a clean bill of health.
I am amazed and surprised at the optimism of the American market right now. The size of Citi and the ability of Citi to bring down the entire financial services industry by itself leads me to believe that we're missing something fairly big here.
Other analysts here, however, have been more positive, saying the tests show that overall the U.S. banking industry is in a healthier state than it was, and certainly healthier than European banks. After all, no U.S. bank has been told to increase its capital immediately, whereas here in Europe, banks are still scrambling to beef up their balance sheets.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thank you very much.
Okay, David.
And for another take on this, let's bring in Josh Brown, our regular Wednesday guest. He's with Fusion Analytics, and he joins us from New York. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Well, Josh, sounds like the banks are doing well, too. These stress tests happened, and 15 of the 19 passed, as I said. But as we've had stress tests over the last few years, both here and in Europe, a lot of times people look back and say they weren't really that tough. Why are they being taken so seriously this time?
I think what we do here is a lot more serious than what they do in Europe. And I think that these stress tests were pretty transparent and legitimate in terms of the methodology. They basically tested how these banks would react and how their balance sheets would hold up against the scenario where unemployment was 13%, which is significantly higher than where it had gotten to, let's say, in the depths of the crisis in 2009 or 2010.
And how did they do so well, Josh?
Well, they didn't all do so well, but, you know, many of these banks have spent the last few years shedding assets, getting out of capital-intensive businesses, ratcheting down how much leverage or how much borrowing they've been doing in order to earn returns. They got the message that it was time to shrink, and almost across the board, they shrank those parts of their businesses.
Josh, let me ask you about something else that's getting a lot of attention this morning, an op-ed in the New York Times by a resigning Goldman Sachs executive named Greg Smith. And he says about the culture at Goldman, quote, "I can honestly say that the environment now is as toxic and destructive as I have ever seen it." And he goes on to talk about how the firm, in his view, only cares about its own bottom line, not the clients. What do you make of this?
It's a little dramatic. It's a little bit Jerry Maguire-ish. I think the takeaway is really that that's the business Wall Street is in, is to make money. Now, are there people making comments about the customers, et cetera, that are distasteful? I'm sure you can find the same kind of thing in every other business, law firms, restaurants, et cetera. So I think it's a little bit dramatic. I think the rhetoric is a little bit fiery, but I get what he's saying. Wall Street has always been about itself at the end of the day.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
There's been grumbling among rival banks about JPMorgan Chase getting a jump yesterday on the markets with an early release of the results of its stress test before the Federal Reserve issued its official results later in the day. However, the Wall Street Journal today cites a senior Fed official suggesting it wasn't JPMorgan's fault, but instead a miscommunication.
Well, now to the stress the rest of us are experiencing, gas prices that are averaging $3.81 a gallon. And here in Los Angeles, it's about a dollar more than that. So I went over to California Automotive in the Valley the other day to get some gas-saving tips from the owner, mechanic Rebecca Flyshaker. She started by checking the air in my tires to make sure they were properly inflated.
So we have this little tool, and we're going to check it. And it's telling us that you have 40 pounds of pressure. So 40 for this tire, I think, is very good.
So I'm in good shape.
You're perfect.
What about driving? How fast should you be driving to get the best fuel economy?
Well, it's just not going to happen. What you want to do is 55 miles an hour on the freeway for 10 miles without stopping on your brakes. That's fantastic.
I have to admit, I do tend to drive faster than 55 on the freeway.
And most of us do.
Now, when we're filling up our car with gas, we have a choice. We have
right.
The 87, the low end, the mid-grade, and then the high end, the 91.
Correct.
What's the difference?
My opinion is everyone should use 91 octane, but because it's more filtered, not because of the octane. But typically, super unleaded has more filtering in it, so we have less particulate matter. It burns much cleaner, cooler, much more efficiently.
So you're saying even if you don't have to use that in your car, you should buy the expensive gas to save money in the long run?
That's exactly what I'm saying, and you can prove it to yourself. Why don't you do this? Just for one tank full of gas, write the mileage down, see how many gallons you pump in, go until the same mileage the next time, refill it up. You know, if you were at 87, go to 91, go through that fuel tank and see what happens. You should get better fuel economy. It's just more efficient the way that it actually works when it's inside the vehicle.
All right, so use the expensive gas, drive 55 miles an hour, make sure your tires are properly filled up with air.
That's correct.
What else?
A really big thing that you can do, and you really should start at, is making sure, number one, that the air filter is clean. If the air filter is plugged up, you could get as much as 25% lower efficiency because it can't bring the air in properly, so your air-fuel mixture will be off. You'll be burning more fuel. Number two, if the oil level is correct and clean, That is fantastic because heat is the major factor inside an engine as to how efficient you can be. Another big thing is if you have a whole bunch of stuff in your trunk, it really is a vehicle that's moving. It's not a closet. So if you can take out do this, go home, take everything out of your trunk and put it on a scale. And I would lay money that you'd have at least 30 to 40 pounds, but the average is 200 pounds worth of extra stuff in your trunk. That's a whole other human body that you're carrying around that you don't need to.
But maybe you don't need to keep the kids' sleds in the car and stuff like that.
No skateboards, no. You know, unless you're going there. You're going there to use it, great, and then put it back in your garage.
Now, I spend probably, I would say, $50 every 10 days filling up my tank with gas.
Okay.
How much do you think I could save if I were to do all the things that you said?
Well, if you added up the percentages, wash the car, 2% more efficiency. Air pressure, 2% more efficiency. The air filter, if it was plugged up to 25%. Having the oil clean up to 15%, you're already at 40%.
Rebecca Fleischaker, owner of California Automotive, thanks for all the tips you've given us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The solar power industry has been in the doghouse after industry biggie Solyndra went under, despite all its government subsidies. But there's a report out today that shows that we've just come off a boom year for solar. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
The Solar Energy Industries Association says U.S. solar installations grew more than 100% last year. Roan Resch is president.
The solar industry has grown faster than any other industry in the United States.
Percentage-wise, solar is still a small part of the U.S. energy economy. The triple-digit growth came as developers sped up solar projects to meet a 2011 deadline for federal grants, and the price of solar panels plunged about 50%. Chalk that up to China.
China now manufactures over two-thirds of all the solar in the world.
But that doesn't necessarily mean a loss for U.S. solar companies, says UC Berkeley energy professor Dan Kamen, because American firms still lead in solar installation gear, software, and financing products like solar leases.
There's also huge room for innovation, and these U.S. companies are major innovators.
Kamen says the growth in U.S. solar is sustainable as long as companies find their market niche and don't try to do it all. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The preferred drink in England may be tea, but starting today, if you're in the UK and you want coffee instead from Starbucks, you're going to have to get a little personal. Instead of your drink order, Starbucks will shout out your name. It's an attempt by Starbucks to win customers with friendliness, but are Brits really ready to look past their famous reserve and be on a first-name basis with their baristas? In our Midday Extra today, here's the BBC's Kate McGough.
Here in Britain, we like our personal space. But starting today, every Starbucks barista in London will be taking names. Up until now, if you ordered a grande latte in a British Starbucks, you'd know when to pick it up when they called out grande latte. Now, the Starbucks here will sound like those in the US. If I order a coffee, the barista will call out Kate. And that's causing a bit of a stir. It's a policy of friendliness Starbucks says it hopes will help it stand out in the crowded UK coffee market. But Londoner Simon Jones doesn't think getting on first name terms will work for him.
It doesn't add much value for me, and I think it's a lot of extra work for them, because I also work in, you know, selling retail, and I know how time-consuming it is to make something personalised.
To launch their friendlier coffee, Starbucks is giving away around 350,000 free coffees across the UK today. And they're lining up out the door at Starbucks across London. But maybe it's just for the free espresso. Here's Londoner Steve Banjo.
It doesn't bother me, to be honest with you. I just get my coffee and I'm out of here.
In London, I'm the BBC's Kate McGough for Marketplace.
Now to the weirdest Groupon deal that I have ever seen. This is obviously the online coupon site, and they're offering a trip to the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, the site of the Titanic wreck, to be specific.
Sounds kind of cool.
It does. $12,500 is the cost that Groupon will let you pay for this. That's 79% off the retail price.
An amazing deal.
Exactly. You get to go down in one of those deep ocean vessels as part of a 13-day excursion. But if you're not sold on that, keep in mind that $12,500 also includes a DVD of Titanic signed by a Leonardo DiCaprio impersonator.
All right, now that's a fine deal. Now, if they throw in the DVD, I'll pay the $12,000. You You may have heard the Panama Canal is getting a makeover. In 2 years, it'll be able to handle ships big enough to carry twice the cargo. Now, yesterday, we told you the expansion could hurt West Coast ports that currently serve ships too big to squeeze through the canal. Today, we look at how East Coast ports are playing this. From New York, Janet Babin reports.
If you're at the New York Container Terminal Yard in Staten Island, you do not want to be walking around without a hard hat and some neon clothing. Up to 8 cargo ships dock here each week. After they arrive, longshoremen use a crane to drop the 40-foot containers onto waiting trucks lined up next to the ship that then whiz off with their new cargo.
What is coming in?
Your boots, your coat, the hard hats, my shirt, everything.
That's New York Container Terminal's Joe Cordero. The ship is more than 3 football fields long and looks enormous. But it's tiny compared to ships that could sail here after the Panama Canal expansion. Bob Silverman's a supply chain expert with Jones Lang LaSalle.
The canal expansion is going to allow bigger ships to go through the canal and essentially reduce the cost of moving an ocean container from Asia to, you know, the East Coast ports.
Silverman says that'll put the Midwest in play. For the first time, it could be cheaper to get stuff to the heartland from the East Coast. Port operators from Florida up are deepening harbors, preparing for an onslaught of new customers. But Rick Larrabee with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey says it'll be a battle.
The West Coast ports are not going to sit by idly and watch this. So between the West Coast ports and their partners in the rail business, for instance, or the trucking business, they're going to continue to compete for the business.
Railroad and gas prices will also be a factor in which coast wins. In New York and New Jersey, there's another issue, too. The supersized freighters won't fit under the Bayonne Bridge that connects Staten Island and New Jersey. Larrabee says the region will spend $1 billion to lift the bridge.
We're kind of playing a little bit of catch-up here.
If Panama Canal construction remains on schedule, the monster ships will be able to sail up the Atlantic coast by 2014. Unfortunately for the longshoremen working these New York docks, the supersized ships won't fit under the Bayonne Bridge or into this harbor until 2 years after that. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Now, Jeremy, when I say New York Yankees, what smell, what aroma comes to mind?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Probably, I don't know, hot dogs and peanuts and
All right. Now, Red Sox fans listening, you can participate here as well. I ask because the Yankees are coming out with an official cologne. Billboards are apparently on the way, along with ads on the number 4 subway that goes to Yankee Stadium, a train that already has its own distinctive scent, right? The story in Advertising Age says the Yankee cologne is supposed to smell like success.
Wow. That's like the last place I would expect a cologne to come from, the New York Yankees.
Well, there you go. We'll give it a try. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
On APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.